attorneys for Ms. Taylor's family have questioned whether Mr. Cameron presented all of the evidence and gave the grand jury the opportunity to consider homicide charges against the officers, or if his office decided on its own that such charges were unwarranted. Mr. Cameron said in a statement Monday that the only charge his office recommended to the grand jury was the one against Mr. Hankinson for wanton endangerment. A juror filed a motion in state court on Monday citing concerns about how Mr. Cameron presented the case and seeking the release of all recordings, transcripts, and reports of the grand jury. The juror also asked the court for a declaration allowing members of the grand jury to disclose information and details about the proceedings. At the arraignment for Mr. Hankinson on Monday, in which he pleaded not guilty, Judge Ann Bailey Smith ordered that the recording of the grand jury proceedings be filed by noon Wednesday. Ahead of the deadline, Mr. Cameron's office sought an extension to redact personal information of witnesses named in the recording for their protection. The judge granted the request on Wednesday, giving the Attorney General's office until noon Friday to submit the audio. In a statement on Monday, Mr. Cameron said, "Once the public listens to the recording, they will see that over the course of 2.5 days, our team presented a thorough and complete case to the grand jury."
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Texas Monthly Archives, followed by Senior Notes at 8.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 81 and clear.
Tonight, clear with a low in the low 60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-60s.
From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 7 p.m.
Welcome to Texas Monthly Archives. Each week, Recording Library volunteers and staff dig into past editions of the National Magazine of Texas.
Hi, this is Linda. Who's number one in the Permian Basin? For generations, Midland and Odessa have been going at it out in West Texas. Now, at last, someone has noticed. By Larry L. King. Published in the June 1975 Texas Monthly. From any decent distance, these lonely sisters of the barren flat plain, these isolated twin mini-cities of the vast Permian Basin, Midland and Odessa, appear more alike than not. Their differences may seem paltry or superficial, or not to exist at all to the visitor blasting across Interstate 10 toward Fort Worth or El Paso, for there is a peapod sameness, a tuneless monotony of brown land and anemic blue sky in these baked badlands where often the wind grows angry and spits hot sand. It is not country to invite most eyes or green most spirits, this outback land where I spent my formative years, this ancient seabed that now is a moonscape without the moon's mysteries to recommend it. After about an hour of it, after miles of oil derricks, runty little stands of sagebrush or greasewood, and billboards plugging steakhouses, country music radio, automobile or insurance bargains, one may begin to wonder where Texas keeps its blue bonnets or America stores its purple mountain majesties. One also may wonder where Odessa ends and Midland begins, or vice versa. Couldn't you lump the sister cities in a single heap and call them Midessa, possibly without even their chambers of commerce noting? No, you could not. Proud denizens of each community, from bankers to barbers to roughnecks, would feel deprived and robbed to the point of war. There is an almost comic edge to their rivalry, in each community's assumption that it has the drop and the goods over the other. There are differences in the towns, though not so powerful or so varied, probably, as the natives like to think. And certainly there is a mutual dedication toward maintaining them. It is more somehow than neighbors fighting for their respective shares of a common economic pie, and more than communities routinely tussling to see who lands the four-year college or gets to brand its name on a shared airport, though these certainly are part of the traditional squabbling. The two towns are much the products of their histories, says Odessa trial lawyer Warren Burnett. A long time ago, Midland decided to take the high road. That's why the law offices over there have drapes and deep rugs, and everybody talks in hushed tones. Odessa, on the other hand, has little demand for corporate lawyers. We are a bunch of sweat hog lawyers over here, getting it on in the courtrooms. We tend to drink in bars. Midland lawyers drink at home. He is not merely generalizing his own example. My Midland friends, lawyers or otherwise, invite me to their homes. Odessa chums transport me to or meet me in public places. My Odessa comrades, whatever their vocations, more willingly abandon their duties to accommodate my random, unannounced midday recreations. Midland pals generally put me off until the post-work hours. Odessa, in this particular, shares instincts with Fort Worth. Midland is more of Dallas, serious-minded and buttoned down. One can trace back this legitimate difference in styles, if not to root beginnings, at least to the late 1930s or early 1940s, when geologists began to suspect that the two desert towns, only 18 miles apart, and then of fewer than 10,000 people each, sat smack in the middle of a rich oil pool. Midland opted to become the financial center. With fortunes earlier established in cattle and cotton, the old first families, the Scarbers, Cowdens, Lancasters, Brunsons, Pecks, Barons, Joels, Proctors, Holtz, Ulmers, et al., decided their banks would lend money for oil speculation. In retrospect, it seems a rather remarkable decision, something like Baptist deacons voting to sponsor a dice tournament or girly show. For these were conservative hulks in their politics and in their personal habits, the descendants of hard scrabblers who had dribbled and drifted into the lonesome territory in the 1870s or 1880s, to slowly build a windmill town called Midway because of its location smack between Dallas and El Paso. Their cattle empires had not been forged without pain, sweat, and loss. Many, for years, were land poor, their acreages alternately baked or flooded. Grasses often were sparse. Herds seeking forage or fleeing sudden violent storms wandered away across the open range. Sometimes a few remaining marauding Indians stole horses or butchered precious beef. The fittest survived, and as Darrell Royal says, the biggins ate the littlins plumb up. When Midland's biggins decided to loan money in a big way for oil speculation as World War II ended and manpower and materials were in goodly supply, they were not exactly running foolish riverboat gambler risks. No, for by then geologists had confirmed earlier suspicions. The bald desert literally reeked of oil. The subterranean Permian Basin pool covered a grand expanse of the old prehistoric Permian Sea, and tested out richer than fresh cowplop. It was, simply, one of the richest strikes to be found anywhere, and even some few fools and dreamers became wealthy. Midland's old first families themselves owned much of the underground wealth. Their ancestors, tenaciously accumulative, sometimes had left spreads reaching into other Permian Basin counties and even far up into New Mexico. Their descendants had the then sacrosanct 27.5% oil depletion allowance going for them, which made tax time almost as merry a season as Christmas. They did not urge money on you just because you wanted to hunt oil or thought you knew where to find it. But if you could show decent prospects, a hopeful geological survey, proximity to earlier drilling successes, an option to explore where the signs looked good, then Midland's banks would finance you to their long-term profit. Independent oilmen swarmed in from all over, as did draftsmen and landmen and scouts and geologists and technicians and Ivy League lawyers. All these energetic movers and shakers needed facilities, so Midland's banks plowed their capital into mini skyscrapers, 19 stories, 24, 29. It was astonishing to see a budding Dallas springing from the flat desert floor, and soon the major oil companies, as well as the independents, became tenants. Midland bragged on itself as headquarters city of the vast Permian Basin Empire. New hotels, restaurants, country clubs, and housing developments multiplied themselves. Street names reflected the new influx: Harvard Drive, Yale Street, Princeton Circle. The less fortunate found a new recreation: driving around West Midland to view sprawling new homes, some looking like Mussolini-era depots or the Ramada Inns of a later day, or old stone forts with their manicured lawns and landscaped trees or shrubs. Some prosperous newcomers, agitated by blowing sands during the windy season, erected costly, high, and ineffectual fences as protection. Everybody wore burr haircuts, neckties, class rings, and hopes of riches on their sleeves. Midland's full of $8,000 a year millionaires, Odessans like to sneer. There was the roughneck's contempt of the fop in it, yes, but the community sneer also transported a certain sour grapes jealousy. Odessa literally kept a low profile. You could scarcely see its skyline from the nearby oil fields. Its banks having risked no big money, and its community fathers then lacking Midland's stubborn, feverish, dreamy boosterisms, it remained a vulgar sprawl of a town, the home of pipe yards, oil well servicing outfits, tool companies, mud companies, trucking companies, construction companies, many operating from shacks or Quonset huts. It was Tent City ugly, the bedroom town of the driller and the lowly roustabout, who suffered the fumes and rattlings of growling giant trucks. It had the feel and smell of grease in its pores. Along the clutter of the East 8th Street dives, you could find the sort of action you craved: beer-drinking music, fisticuffs, dice or card opportunities, painted ladies for hire. To be a police reporter there was to visit the hospital emergency room often. Great were the stabbings and shootings and simple country butt stomps, and to find the jails bursting at the seams. Where Midland boasted its grand homes, Odessa was a hodgepodge of frame houses built like cracker boxes for the most part, an arabesque settlement of odors and backyard goat pens or rabbit hutches. It was only natural. More oil reposed near or in Odessa than was the case with Midland. This geological happenstance, or was it a signal of God's Texas will, kept the sour, gassy, vomity stink in the air, kept the flares and the sump pits burning at night, kept the fry cook cafes preparing sack lunches, kept the $3 motels full, kept the beer and the adrenaline and the blood flowing, kept the crews working around the clock towers. Odessa lighted the dark desert with thousands of flares and hundreds of drilling rig lights. The casual nocturnal passerby might have judged himself to have stumbled on an undiscovered metropolis. Midland, on the other hand, seemed dark and shuttered. Its native youth complained of sidewalks rolling up at 9 o'clock. Having worked its 8 hours, Midland's white-collar and professional element went to the country club, or to bed, or perhaps to Odessa. It was my misfortune as a teenager in the mid-1940s to live in Midland while harboring Odessa preferences in my soul, my character, and my heritage. I loved the wild clashes and random clamors of Sintown, Odessa's aggressive definition of itself, while despising Midland's controlled, bloodless efficiency and organized civic bustle. What sensitive poor boy truly believes he belongs in a communal entity, advertising itself as headquarters city of the vast Permian Basin Empire? Odessa might break my jaw, sure, but Midland, with its socio-economic snobberies, automatic exclusions, and reflexive acquisitive instincts, seemed a threat to break my spirit. I thought it a pretentious place, one excessively concerned with form and appearance, one full of fake camaraderie and gimlet-eyed hustlers bent on getting the buck. When I read Sinclair Lewis' Main Street, I was astonished to learn that its self-winding promoters and glad-handing exploiters had done their business in Minnesota rather than Midland. One of the great ironies reposed in the barbs of the Odessa High School Broncos when they administered our annual Thanksgiving Day gridiron thumpings. In so many words, they taunted us as rich boys, spoiled sissy britches, and gluttons of privilege. Never mind that more than half of Midland's bulldogs were Southside have-nots, whose fathers roughnecked in the oil patch or night-watched and maybe broke wind at the table. Our civic boosters having done their jobs too well, the Odessa kids took us for Highland Park swells. The image was there, you see, and our proletariat adversaries, whose town, after all, had been named by foreign-born railroad workers for a town in Russia, zinged us with the vigor of Marxists coming to redistribute the wealth. Their savagery was intimidating. We, Sissy Bridges, headquarters city of the vast Permian Basin Empire boys, lost to Sintown by 20-7 and 48-0 in my time. Only by joining the army before my senior season did I avoid the record 55-0 plastering of 1946. High school football was, I think, a legitimate cultural and psychological measuring stick of that time and that place. Many of us concluded that Odessa was indeed the rawer and the tougher community. Neither of these now are particularly warm towns, though Odessa in day-to-day living may come closer to giving that impression. As in an earlier time, Odessa is looser, more informal, more rollicking, more old shoe and howdy-do. But you must remember that we are dealing in relative terms. We are talking essentially about two nervous and uptight communities that continue to respond to their shaping heritages. Midland hung a horse thief from a courthouse tree at the turn of the century. Juries in each town have voted people eligible for the electric chair. Both Midland and Odessa are clenched-jawed, law-and-order towns in the basics, where the natives still love their guns, and where dopers and rapists routinely draw more time than Methuselah could have served. Visiting long hairs continue to receive funny looks in polite society and need only enter the rowdier beer joints to assure their butt stompings. The angry Old Testament God is not dead in the Permian Basin. Indeed, he remains healthy and able to extract his vengeances. Going back for me is like coming out on the other side of a time machine. It could be 1960 again, or maybe the mid-1950s. Last summer, a friend took me to the Odessa Country Club, where the ladies wore silk gowns and high heels and beehive hairdos. Their gentlemen wore white shirts and pinky rings and had not been tempted by mod hairstyles. A middle-aged lady wearing a corsage pumped the organ while her slick-haired, mustachioed partner squeezed an accordion. The crowd sang along of Blue Moons, and of Bicycles Built for Two, and of Good Nights to Irene. For a little while, one might believe that Eisenhower lived, that Gable was back, and Garson had him, that TCU might beat Texas. Politically, this is bedrock conservative territory with the nut wing among rightists well represented. Midland is striped pants Republican, going for Tom Dewey in 1948, and it elected local Republicans long before Odessa with its yellow dog Democrat instincts. Midland so loved Richard Nixon that one almost felt relief when encountering a Scoop Jackson or even a George Wallace Democrat. Odessa once selected General Edwin Walker over John Connally for governor and always treated Ralph Yarbrough as if he carried a social disease. When the John Birch Society discovered that Ike and John Foster Dulles might be leaders of the internal communist conspiracy, it found hundreds of ready West Texas converts. The president of the Odessa JCs indeed became a paid Birch recruiter. Impeach Earl Warren bumper stickers for years outnumbered Jesus messages. When I visited an Odessa bookstore in the late 1960s while on a promotion tour, the Birchers posted a lady who wrote down all the dangerous things I said. Periodically, in both Midland and Odessa, vigilantes attempt to pluck Hemingway, Steinbeck, Vonnegut, and other dangerous or trashy writers from the library shelves. But it's better now, a late 30-ish Odessa merchant insisted. We were drinking a pair of golden Scotch mists in the Golden Rooster Club, high atop the Inn of the Golden West, and looking down on miles and miles of flat brown. He said, "You don't have all that hate and suspicion of the McCarthy years, or when the Birchers ran wild. You know, for a while out here, it looked like the kook element might take over the school boards and city hall. But they raised so much silly hell and made so many improbable charges that it scared folks. And it was the responsible businessmen who banded together to stop 'em. We told folks, hell, you can't have disruptive forces in charge of things." Still, the West Texas version of moderation leaves something to be desired. Students of the new 1973 University of Texas of the Permian Basin at Odessa are still complaining of authorities censoring their school paper and firing its editor in 1974. One hears of battles breaking out in the public schools over the vital matter of proper dress codes, and occasional patriots picket visiting speakers harboring loose ideas. Maybe the fundamentalists have had to fire and fall back, but they're still in there sniping. Such natural conservative reflexes as were handed down by the region's original settlers, independent isolationist critters willing to risk a raw country in exchange for individual opportunities, have been reinforced and continue to be reinforced by the one-note drummings of what Harry Truman called the one-party press. Of course, the safely monopolistic newspapers in each city fail to run the risks of the early day pioneers. Hell, they don't even run the risks of that competitive free enterprise system they so doggedly recommend to the rest of us as they preach against meddling feds, godless reds, labor unions, and government spending or sapping taxations at all levels. The chain-owned Odessa American, a product of Freedom Newspapers, with headquarters in Orange County, California, is the more blunt and strident. The home-owned Midland Reporter-Telegram tends to pussyfoot, or hem and haw. In essence, however, they serve the same masters. KOSA-TV Odessa, the CBS outlet, has a long history of Tory owners and managers who have protectively offered sitcom reruns or old movies whenever they found network documentaries excessively leftist. KMID-TV Midland, the NBC affiliate, is less sensitive to such menaces. You could fry in the sun, however, if you waited on a corner until any of the media outlets decided to probe or explore poverty, racism, institutional injustices, or otherwise critically examine their bailiwicks. In this, however, they probably are guilty of little more neglect than the Texas norm. City reporters may rake a little muck in Houston or Dallas, but in Amarillo and Abilene, or in Lufkin or Lubbock, you will not find much dirt disturbed. Unless the wind does it. When Midland was a windmill town in the late 1880s, its town boosters and Texas and Pacific Railroad officials made a decision that may still haunt it. They refused to seek government emergency aid, while others did, during a disastrous two-year drought that starved cattle herds and dried up water holes. But Midland's citizens had sunk everything they had in the future, John Howard Griffin wrote in his Land of the High Sky, and they did not want the rest of the world to know the true situation. While the land lay parched, the people underplayed the disaster. This inherited inclination not to face reality and to soft-pedal shortcomings or failures accounts in some measure for Midland's having been outstripped by Odessa in recent years. Midland's civic leaders and community dads, in effect, proved short-sighted. They put all their economic eggs in one basket, depending on a white-collar and professional workforce, and they built skyscrapers and housing developments as if the merry boom would never end. By the mid-1960s, however, as oil production lost its potential for dizzy quick profits due to restricted allowables and world market conditions, many independent operators went under. The major oil companies retrenched by first trimming their white-collar fat. Midland lost, in each case. The companies which did not close their local operations pared them to the bone, transferring their main forces to Tulsa or Houston or elsewhere. Suddenly, Midland had 1,700 surplus dwellings on its hands and many semi-empty skyscrapers. The population, which had grown to 67,000 in 1960, slipped back to 58,000 despite a high local birth rate. People lost their jobs at the Chamber of Commerce. Civic leaders dreamed of renovating downtown. Billboards were posted on the outskirts calling attention to Midland's good business climate. Nothing much happened. The problem began long before it was apparent, as most problems do. Like Fort Worth, when the late Amon Carter and his ruling pals aged or died, Midland had made few provisions for replacing its natural leaders. As early as 1950, though the fact then was obscured by the runaway boom, its formerly vigorous old-timers began to lose their visions and their grips. Midland at that time refused to join the Upper Colorado River Authority, a mistake Odessa did not make, and 15 years would pass before the city, after many costly drilling operations discovering dry holes, found water sources sufficient to encourage modern industry. As the old leaders withered, perhaps they became less concerned with the future than in a comfortable present and in hanging on to the past. The prevailing attitude ran well, we got a nice little town here. We don't need to mess it up with labor troubles and factories and a certain class of people. Midland settled down to building a spiffy little theater and a symphony orchestra that played in white ties, each with its own imported full-time professional director, and to counting its money and its blessings. Its banks and newspapers hired artists and writers to capture the spirit of Midland on canvas and in books. Everybody played a lot of golf and drank martinis. Odessa, in the same period, was coming into an aggressive new wealth and spawning a new generation of go-getters determined to keep the good times rolling. A diversified economy was their goal. By the mid-1950s, Odessa was on the way to landing a sizable petrochemical complex and was building a huge county coliseum in which to stage a profitable biennial commercial oil show, plus everything from rodeos to wrestling to rock band concerts, at a time when Midland was surrendering because of a lack of facilities and community interest, its traditional world championship rodeo. It was dispatching civic squads far and wide to attract government or private funding. The city grew its own modest skyline and constructed a replica of the Stratford-on-Avon Shakespearean Theater. Whenever Odessa and Midland vied for four-year colleges or new post offices or district courts or regional offices of state agencies, Odessa somehow seemed to get there first. Today, though Midland held a slight population edge through the early 1940s, and the growth battle remained close for another 20 years, Odessa claims more than 83,000 people to Midland's 58,000 and has clearly become the area trade center. Not that either city is much of a paradise to a former resident of both, now that he has much roaming on his record. Though fast food operations offer a variety of delicacies from pizza to barbecue to shrimp to Mexican specialties to chicken broiled, fried, baked, and maybe spanked, it may be safely said that neither Midland nor Odessa offers anything remotely resembling a first-class restaurant. If you asked to see the wine cellar, they'd think you were anticipating a tornado. Movies reach these Permian Basin precincts only after much aging in the can. There is not a truly decent bookstore in either city. The magazine racks recommend a high percentage of detective stories, mechanical manuals, homemaking hints, and almost as many porn offering as Times Square outlets. Unless you crave country music or studio evangelists or 13 super loud and frantic commercials per 6 minutes, you have small use for your West Texas radio. About all I find to do there, outside of enjoying the company of a precious few old friends, is drink and hope for an improbable romantic adventure while waiting for my flight to be called. It's either that or a big night in the Christian Science reading room. Sin City has become Dullsville. However, your tireless researcher, doggedly at work in Odessa's White Buffalo Saloon, did make the acquaintance of a young topless dancer newly arrived from Philadelphia by way of Los Angeles. "Why'd you stop here?" he demanded, clearly implying that surely she had run out of gas, lost her road map, or might be on the lam with Patty Hearst. "Honey," she said, "I read they was having a boom out here. A boom means money. And money means I'm going to be real happy in my surroundings." Yes, it's true. Even as much as America suffers unaccustomed economic rigors, the sober inheritors of the old Permian Basin are having themselves a first-class oil boom out there, thanks to the energy shortage, rising oil prices, and the tough new attitudes of Arabian sheiks. When Walter Cronkite devoted a couple of minutes to the Odessa boom, the town was overrun by migrants seeking work. Local officials say the influx brought unemployment up from 2 to 3.1%. But hell, a barber says, you can hold two jobs if you're willing to work. All it takes is want to. And an independent operator complains, getting the hardware's the problem. Hell, if I had the drill pipe and the rotary rigs, I'd be getting good rich. Everybody kind of let their equipment run down in the last few years. Not much drilling was going on, and when things opened up, it caught us off base. There's even a goddamn black market in drilling gear.
Now that Linda has read about the rivalry in West Texas, we're going to read about other rivalries of cities in the eastern part of the state. This article is called Texas's Cities, One Big Dysfunctional Family, chronicling the rivalries of Houston, Dallas, Fort Worth, San Antonio, and Austin, by John Nova Lomax, August 2015. Although some like to claim overreaching state pride trumps all smaller considerations, Texas towns have been claiming superiority over each other since the days of the Republic. Maybe it was that little business of Austin stealing the capital from Houston in 1839 that birthed this sibling rivalry. Or perhaps it was a half century or so later, when Dallas cotton growers connived with Galveston cotton exporters to build a railroad bypassing their mutual enemy, Houston. Small towns have their vicious football rivalries. But for sheer volume of insults and Homerism, the five cities of the Texas Triangle offer the most fertile ground for discussion today. Here it is in a nutshell. Fort Worth hates Dallas. Houston hates Dallas and Austin. San Antonio hates Austin. Austin wishes all the rest of us would just go away. And Dallas pretends that none of the rest of us even exist. All right, hate is a strong word. But imagine these cities as five brothers in a dysfunctional, but yes, ultimately loving family. We perused citydata.com, where residents defend their cities and bash others, to understand the source of all of this beef. Can't we just get along, y'all? The family. San Antonio is the oldest sibling. Actually, make that half-sibling, as he was conceived and later raised to young adulthood by Mother Texas's first two husbands, Spain and Mexico. Today, he is the most traditional and quietly self-confident of the brothers. You never hear chest beating out of San Antonio. Only self-deprecating, quietly proud in-jokes, like its 2000s grassroots Keep San Antonio Lame campaign. It preserves its old architecture. Its natural setting is almost as pleasant as that of Austin. Its boastful, exhibitionist baby brother, who lives just north on Interstate 35. San Antonio couldn't believe it when Austin started daring to claim to make better breakfast tacos, and is puzzled and a little hurt that Austin never invites San Antonio to his parties. Dallas and Houston are warring fraternal twins. Houston has always resented Dallas for being better at football, hates how global pop culture sees Dallas as the world's oil capital when it is not, and thinks he is a little materialistic for Houston's taste. You know what really galls Houston about Dallas? Creator David Jacobs was inspired by Blood and Money, an epic true crime tale that took place in Houston. With the exceptions of Austin, which Dallas loves to try to impress with a newfound impetus toward coolness, and scrappy little sidekick Fort Worth, the city gaslights every other Texas locale, but especially Houston. Rivalry? Dallas asks. What rivalry? We don't have a rivalry with Houston. Nobody up here even thinks of Houston. One of countless examples from Dallas enthusiasts on the net. Living in the Dallas area for 35 years, I never heard anyone say anything negative about Houston. Nor did I ever hear anyone compare Dallas to Houston. Dallas views Houston as its untidy big brother that it does not wish to emulate. Houston versus Dallas exists as a rivalry only on sites like this one. In the real world, Dallas doesn't see Houston as a rival. It sees Atlanta and Chicago as rivals. Houston may or may not feel the same. That's the kind of talk that makes Houston's blood boil, in the same vein as when Longhorns tell Aggies that OU Sooners are their real rivals,
when Houston insists that the rivalry does exist and that Dallas's constant denial of that existence is proof. And then Dallas sticks the dagger in. Five Super Bowls, Houston. Five. And then Dallas drops the mic and exits stage left. But underneath all of its feigned obliviousness to other Texas cities, there does seem to lurk a current of self-loathing. As East Dallas resident Mamie Joseph puts it, Dallas is too busy hating itself to notice anybody else. That observation was borne out 4 years back when I wrote a piece for the Houston Press and Dallas Observer about how those two cities were getting cooler while Austin was becoming more businesslike and big city. The piece was met with near universal praise in Houston, but about half the feedback I got from Dallas was that I was a lunatic to think that way and that only their jobs were keeping them from escaping to Austin ASAP. Meanwhile, Houstonians were printing up T-shirts with slogans like, "I'm not moving to Austin," and "Keep Austin 170 miles from Houston." Finally, Dallas loves to remind Houston that Houston drinks Dallas's toilet water. Really? Not only has Houston had to put up with Dallas's denying its existence, but he has, as one professor put, been drinking Dallas's crap for decades. Dallas is an even worse version of the big brother that doesn't lift the seat. Want to know why Houston and San Antonio are starting to hate Austin almost as much as Dallas? Piffle like this. Austin is the city in Texas that most appeals to coastal opinion makers. Dallas is a corporate bore. Houston is a monumental mess. San Antonio is too Mexican. In Texas, no one thinks about El Paso or Fort Worth. In South by Southwest, Austin throws the best party in the state. Austin has much better scenery, a much better downtown, and a much longer and more established tradition of liberalism than any other Texas city. While I think that Houston is the most interesting city in Texas, it is too sprawling and ugly to compete with Austin. Boosters of other Texas cities hate Austin because it has a deservedly better national reputation. I live in downtown Austin. I travel for work all over the state. Downtown Austin is the only live-work-play neighborhood in the state. Dallas and Houston have many more amenities, but you have to drive, and drive far. Texans hate Austin because it is smarter, prettier, better educated, and way cooler than where they live. The perpetually attention-seeking baby of the brothers, yes, it's a year or so older than Dallas, but its late bloom into a major city makes it seem like the youngest by far, was once the state's Adonis, justifiably vain thanks to its violet-crowned sunsets in the hills, its life-giving cool springs, its moon towers, and its lakes and waterfalls. Not so much anymore. Now it's reminding me of Jim Morrison in his terminal Paris phase, bloated beyond sustainability and drinking too much. Water, in Austin's case, not absinthe or whatever Jim put in that early grave. Austin is most shrill in its put-downs of its older and uglier fraternal twins, precisely because it knows that it is coming to resemble them more and more with each wave of newcomers. I know tech is sexy as far as corporate America goes, but wacky as the culture can be at some firms, many are just boring and soul-crushing as a Dallas bank or insurance company. Austin calling Houston a monumental mess is rich when its highway system is stretched to the breaking point already, its sprawl reaches halfway to Waco, and almost all the way down to San Antonio, and there's no real plan to fix any of that on the horizon. Hence, all the futile outcry lamenting the Dallasizing and Houstonization of Austin, and, of course, the Keep Austin Weird campaign. According to Woodlands journalist Albert Nurek, that kayak slipped its moorings on Lady Bird Lake long ago. Austin tore down Austin and replaced it with "We're weird, seriously, we are land." Unlike the ancient Houston versus Dallas rivalry, This Austin versus the rest of Texas deal is a new phenomenon, dating back about 20 years or so, around the time that slacker led Austin to deem itself the cool kid. Austin's most vociferous Dallas and Houston bashers are most often refugees from the burbs of those very cities. Nobody can dish out venom on Dallas or Houston than a 20-something Austin newcomer who grew up in Plano or Katy. As Houston's poet laureate Gwendolyn Zepeda puts it, "When I was in Austin in the 90s, what made it intolerable was people from Houston and Dallas suburbs who had gone to UT and then decided to stay. They were always saying, 'Austin is so much better than Houston, where I grew up.' And I'd be like, 'You mean Clear Lake? You told me you grew up in Clear Lake, Amber.'" Or as we found it on the many city rivalry internet battles on citydata.com, "In reality, Austin is no more weird or liberal than Inner Loop Houston is. In fact, when I was growing up in Houston during the 70s and early 80s, Austin's brand of weird or bohemian culture, as it were, seemed pretty tame compared to the Montrose area of Inner Loop Houston. Montrose has since been heavily gentrified, but I'd say it's still on par with Austin's most liberal bohemian areas, which are hardly a majority of Austin as a whole. Houston just doesn't toot its horn constantly about these things, the way Austin does. You have to understand, a good chunk of Austin's population is made up of people who moved there from the mostly white suburban areas of Houston and DFW, mostly through attending UT and then staying on as full-time Austinites. Many of these people lived very sheltered lives as kids and never really took the time to explore what their core cities had to offer. They just stayed safely within their suburban bubbles until it was time for college. They got to Austin and discovered all these new, to them, things, decided these things must only exist in Austin, within the state of Texas, that is, and stayed there. And once ensconced, the newly minted Austinites started yelling at the rest of us not to move there, just like a little brother. The mighty Metroplex, dissed for decades as a colorless, conformist jumble of cities and suburbs, it has become a roaring engine of economic growth, and it is reigniting Dallas's fading star. By Michael Ennis, Texas Monthly Edition, January 2007. There was a time when no sober-minded Dallasite could utter the word Metroplex without an ironic smirk. A catch-all for Dallas, Fort Worth, and the dozens of lesser municipalities around and between them, the term was coined in the 70s to boost the region's new centerpiece, the sprawling Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. But DFW was a progeny of a forced marriage. The federal government, weary from maintaining separate airports for the bickering burgs, held the shotgun. And its arrival hardly augured a big, happy regional family. On the one hand, you had booming Big D, which by the early 80s had become the glittering star of the world's most popular television series. And on the other, rest of the Metroplex, home to a lot of envious goobers who didn't know Anne Klein from Calvin Klein. As recently as 2000, federal officials tried to classify the entire 12-county Metroplex as nothing more than a giant statistical suburb of Big D. Only the howls of pain from Fort Worth and nearby Arlington, a city with a population of more than 350,000, persuaded the feds to back off calling the whole thing the Dallas Combined Area. But that was then. For the past several years, Dallas has been in an uncharacteristic funk, its population growth flat, and its leaders lamenting its vanishing middle class, troubled schools, dysfunctional government, and chart-topping crime. Distracted by all the hand-wringing, few in Dallas seem to realize that they've suddenly become part of a bigger and more compelling urban success story. Call it the revenge of the Metroplex. Just a few years after nearly being written off the map, it has become a roaring engine of growth and social transformation. And its improbable rise promises to not only reignite Big D's fading star, but also reset our nation's political and cultural compass. How is a region, dissed for decades as a colorless, conformist lightweight, going to do the former, much less the latter? For openers, With a population that has ballooned to nearly 6 million, the Metroplex has quietly become a demographic heavyweight. While Dallas is distressed to find itself drifting down the list of the 10 largest American cities, 7th in 1980, 9th today, the Metroplex, now dubbed by the chastened feds as the Dallas-Fort Worth-Arlington Metropolitan Statistical Area, is currently the nation's fifth largest MSA, but closing so fast on the Philadelphia area that it has almost certainly passed it already. That leaves just the giant Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York metropolitan areas remaining. While they're still a lot bigger, during the past 5 years, the Metroplex has gained more total residents than any of them. Among the nation's largest metro areas, only Atlanta and Houston have had comparable double-digit growth. Stuck in the middle of flyover America, the Metroplex has transformed itself into a globalized fly-to destination, with the world's third busiest airport as its entrepot and a cosmopolitan population that stands on its ear the oft-heard, covertly racist rubric that our nation's multicultural coastal metropolises aren't the real America, the implication being that a more homogeneous heartland presumably is. Yet, here in the heart of real-deal Texas, the nation's largest red state megalopolis is actually a showcase for all-American diversity. Its most populous county, Dallas, voted blue in November, and compared with its closest statistical peer, the Philadelphia MSA, which spills over four blue states, the Metroplex is notably less lily-white, at more than 42% African-American, Asian, or Hispanic, versus the Philly area's 30%. Belying another stereotype or two, the Metroplex also has a higher percentage of college graduates. While Dallas is already a minority-majority city, all that diversity is hardly ghettoized within the city limits. Of the Metroplex's 1.5 million Hispanics, 2/3 of them live outside Dallas, as do all but 1/8 of the area's 250,000 Asians. The bedroom communities that surrounded Dallas a quarter century ago have become mid-sized cities with prominent minority and immigrant populations. Plano, just north of Dallas, has metamorphosed from a farm town of 3,695 residents in 1960 to a wealthy city of 250,000 people today, and 40,000 of them are Asians. From mom-and-pop Salvadoran restaurants to Korean shopping centers and Mexican supermarkets to the Iranians and Indians who started up some of the area's most heavily capitalized technology firms, immigrants are embroidered across the Metroplex economy. Dallas has long boasted of its ambition to be an international city, and it most certainly has become one. The irony is that it's surrounded by a ring of former suburbs that have become international cities as well. Large or small, more or less diverse, all of the Metroplex's cities and towns are locked in mortal combat, a Darwinian struggle for a life-sustaining share of a highly fluid and entrepreneurial economy. Traditionally, prosperity has gone to the outermost as affluent suburbanites search for those coveted better schools and safer neighborhoods. During the 80s, Plano kick-started its economic ascendance by poaching major Dallas-based corporations like Frito-Lay and Ross Perot's EDS. But as newer, more pristine exurbs have marched further north, Plano's high-flying economic indicators have taken a dive. Most of the Metroplex's maturing suburban cities are already feeling a similar pain as they deal with the same sorts of problems that plague Dallas: aging infrastructure, rising crime, maintaining the quality of public education while absorbing all those non-English-speaking immigrants. To stay alive, the suburban cities are turning to urban models for their renewal, embracing once-scorned mass transit, stressing downtown redevelopment, and getting into the culture business with art centers and concert halls. Even the upstart exurbs are starting to make sure their virginal turf has a certain metropolitan veneer, as developers increasingly sell new home buyers on town-like complexes influenced by the new urbanism. If this race to urbanize wasn't competitive enough, there's also Fort Worth. At about half the size of Dallas, it's now the nation's 19th largest city, bigger than Boston or Seattle. And unlike Dallas, still growing at a rapid clip. The grudge match between the two cities predates the Metroplex itself, and the historic airport feud has been superseded by a long-running rivalry over cultural bragging rights. A generation of Dallasites has been galled to admit that a place that still proudly calls itself Cowtown has three world-class museums, each a global architectural landmark as well, all packaged in a nifty cultural district. The center of downtown Fort Worth has more recently been transformed into a pedestrian-friendly shopping and entertainment district, and the city's plans for development along the Trinity River are outpacing Dallas's similar, much more intensely hyped initiative 30 miles downstream. All but besieged by ambitious neighbors, Dallas has come to a widely remarked tipping point. Either grow up and become the cutting-edge center of a mushrooming global megalopolis, or devolve into an urban ghost town like Detroit. To avoid the latter, Dallas movers have focused on the same strategy as many of the Metroplex's lesser municipalities, reinventing their city as, well, a city. Like, say, Chicago, which in 2001 beat out Dallas for the new corporate headquarters of aircraft manufacturing giant Boeing, when company executives found that Big D's cultural life wasn't competitive. True, Dallas has long claimed the nation's largest downtown arts district, but until recently, it was basically an expanse of parking lots bound by a couple of astringently tasteful modernist monuments, the Edward Larrabee Barnes-designed Dallas Museum of Art and the I.M. Pei-designed Symphony Hall, both built back in the 80s. In a city where Picasso once touched off a Red Scare, and which remains one of the largest in the country without a contemporary art museum, Fort Worth, of course, has one of the nation's biggest and best, Dallas's cultural ambitions have historically warred with its fundamental conservatism. But getting bounced by Boeing was a turning point. The languishing arts district got new life, and finally, a museum up to Fort Worth standards, when Dallas developer Raymond Nasher opened his Renzo Piano-designed Nasher Sculpture Center in 2003. Construction is imminent on a sleek new civic hood ornament, a futuristic suspension bridge across the Trinity River by Spanish modernist Santiago Calatrava, with two more planned. The great leap forward, however, will be 2 years from now, when the Arts District debuts the Center for the Performing Arts, a landscaped 10-acre complex anchored by British architect Norman Foster's Opera House, which will be a startling translucent red drum covered with a giant high-tech sun canopy, and Dutch architect Rem Koolhaas's even more iconolistic theater, a transparent 12-story cube where backstage will essentially be stacked on top and bottom of the stage. Like Piano, Foster and Koolhaas create highly interactive buildings that expose their users to the city around them and invite passers-by to become voyeurs. Unlike so many of Dallas's architectural baubles, these buildings are intended as icons of a city center that will actually be inhabited, and the inhabitants are starting to trickle in. Discarded downtown skyscrapers are being converted to luxury condominiums, and the high-rise mixed-use complex planned around the 5-year-old downtown sports arena, after being put on hold, is starting to build out. Uptown, a stylish, pedestrian-friendly neighborhood of shops, apartments, and restaurants linked to the Arts District by trolley, has been booming for more than a decade. Of course, the same kind of thing is happening nationwide, as well as in other Texas cities, like Houston and Austin, which currently has more downtown residents than Dallas. In a lot of places, culture war now means duking it out with civic rivals over whose downtown has the most culture. But the Metroplex is a front particularly worth watching, because this red state region has been so central to that other culture war, the one that for a time put Republicans in control of Congress and the White House. The GOP majority was as much sprawl-based as it was faith-based, with social conservatives fleeing as far as possible from Sodom-like city centers dominated, according to their rhetoric, by pointy-headed, brie-eating, latte-sipping liberal elites intent on aping the morally bankrupt secular culture of old Europe. The Metroplex has long been one of the great engines of this centrifugal conservatism. Veteran political observers oohed at the more than 70% Republican vote in Collin County, which includes Plano, and newer booming exurbs like Frisco, and saw in the ceaseless flight from the center, geographically as well as ideologically, the endless hegemony of social and religious conservatives. But that too was then. With oil prices periodically spiking and energy addiction considered by our most pressing national security issue, long commutes and gas guzzlers no longer present a blessed lifestyle, as President George W. Bush's spokesman put it before September 11th. Now municipalities, large and small, are looking for the center, both geographically and, it seems, politically. And the model of this urban renewal isn't just our own coastal cities with all their sushi-eating elites, but the old Europe so many American conservatives despise for its lack of martial ardor, languorous lunches, and months-long vacations, and seriously pointy-headed intellectuals like Kuhlhaas, who first made his reputation as an author of dense, rabble-rousing theoretical texts on urban planning, and still publishes legendarily hefty polemics between projects. Stranger yet, the benefactors who earned the naming rights to Kuhlhaas' subversive theater are Dallas financier Charles Wiley and his wife Dee. He's best known nationally as the big-spending Bush supporter, who along with his brother and business partner Sam financed nasty attack ads against John McCain during the 2000 Republican primary. But Wiley is far from an anomaly. A lot of the same local plutocrats who reached deep into their pockets to underwrite Bush's Euro-bashing, rural and suburban-based, fiercely anti-intellectual presidency are writing big checks so that Europe's intellectual elite can turn to the center of their hometown into a place more like Barcelona or Paris. To add to that irony, when President Bush leaves office, he is expected to settle in Dallas's most exclusive inner-city residential enclave, Highland Park, where Dick Cheney lived before he became vice president, and bring his presidential library to nearby Southern Methodist University. The rise of the brie-eating, modern art-loving Republican elite in the heart of Bush country doesn't even scratch the surface of the Metroplex's political and cultural complexity. Its blue center now runs on black power. Dallas's disciplined African-American voters, who weren't even fully enfranchised politically until 1991, propelled Democrats to a near clean sweep of the Dallas County Courthouse in the recent midterm elections. Waiting in the wings is the area's huge yet-to-register Hispanic population, more than 350,000 of whom went into the streets last spring to protest Congress's immigration policy. Think of the Metroplex as a giant test tube filled with all of today's critical conflicts: secularism versus religious fundamentalism, immigrants versus nativists, urban versus rural, red versus blue, black versus brown versus white, environmentalism versus unfettered growth. Out of this primordial brew, 21st century American politics and culture are going to emerge in all sorts of surprising new configurations. We had better learn how to say the name of our youngest urban giant with a straight face, because the complicated, rapidly evolving Metroplex now offers an attraction that should make all of its metro area competitors envious: an unmatched view of our nation's future.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear Recording Library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Senior Notes, followed by the History Book Hour at 9.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area.
It's 78 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-60s.
From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Please note that in order to protect the safety of volunteers and staff and recording services around the country at this time, some productions have been reduced or eliminated. The show that follows substitutes for the program regularly scheduled for this time.
I'm Jeff Pressler, turning on the lights of the Make-Believe Ballroom and welcoming you into my crystal studio for another program of the great hits of the 1930s and 1940s. I'm hosting the show to keep the music and traditions of past hosts Martin Block, Al Jarvis, William B. Williams, and the legendary Steve Allen alive. Whether you're one of my longtime listeners or a new listener on public broadcasting or community radio stations across the U.S. or in the U.K., grab your dance ticket, it's free, and let's reminisce. Hello, world, and welcome to another edition of the Make-Believe Ballroom, and thanks for joining me. How about we get things underway with a little big band jazz number with Harry James? Sometime in late 1945, a new partnership took place between Harry and the great arranger Ray Conniff. Although Ray made a big mark during the big band era, he went on to achieve his greatest successes during the 50s and 60s, especially through his popular Ray Conniff Singers. Conniff was a busy guy, and at his peak between 1957 and 1968, he had 28 albums that were in the American Top 40. Let's get back, though, to 1945. James was well aware of Conniff's arranging from Ray's many charts and original jazz compositions, especially for Artie Shaw. One of the first pieces Conniff submitted to James would be a showcase for Harry's jazz trumpet, which evolved to be titled The Beaumont Ride. The Beaumont Ride was it was a refashioning of Conniff's earlier feature for Artie Shaw's jazz clarinet and Roy Eldridge's jazz trumpet that was called Lucky Number. As some of you may know, Harry James was a thoroughbred racehorse owner for many years, and Harry was also known to make a wager or two throughout his life. So that title alone, Lucky Number, would have appealed to the gambling Harry James. But Harry had to have something that was his own showcase, so Conniff, he moved things around a bit in Lucky Number and came up with a new original, which Harry ended up naming in honor of one of his racehorses and a nod to his hometown of Beaumont in Texas. On the Columbia label, Harry James and his orchestra with the Beaumont Ride.